Well, again, good evening. We're going to be doing chapter 13 tonight, our eternal destiny. And we are at the very end of the creed. We have been, for the last several weeks, throughout the entire semester, actually, looking at the section of the catechism that deals with the creed. And the creed lays out for us the basic doctrines of the church. What is it that we believe about God? What is it that we believe about Jesus? What is it we believe about the Holy Spirit? What is it we believe about the church? What is it we believe about Mary and the saints? And now, what is it that we believe about our eternal destiny? What is it that God has prepared and planned for each and every one of us? And so we're going to be dealing with things like death. We're going to be dealing with things like judgment tonight, hell and heaven and purgatory and all of that. So let's just go ahead and be started. What is the meaning of Christian death? Death creates a sense of urgency for us. We are very conscious of death, and almost every religion, not just Christianity or Judaism, but every religion in spirituality tells us that we have to be deeply conscious of death, because death is like the period at the end of the sentence. And it lets us know that we do not have an infinite amount of time to do the things in this life that we want to do. And we do not have an infinite amount of time in this life to make sure that our relationship with God is what it needs to be. That there is a sense of urgency. There is a sense that we need to get things done, because none of us know when that period comes to the end of the sentence. We don't know when that sentence comes to an end. And we need to be very prepared for that. It brings an end to our death, the church says, is our ability to make the decision whether or not I'm going to follow Christ and whether I'm going to accept salvation in my life ends at death. At death, we meet judgment. At death, we meet judgment. And so if I want to go to heaven, I'm going to decide in this life that I'm going to follow Christ. I'm going to decide what kind of a life I'm going to live. And death reminds us, when we live consciously, then we are aware that this is a life that can end at any moment, and that I need to make each and every moment all that it can be. What is it that we believe happens to us when we die? Here we're going to be talking about heaven and hell and purgatory. But the church talks about two judgments. And the second judgment we're going to talk about towards the end of the class. The first judgment is called the particular judgment. And then we have the final judgment. But the particular judgment is the judgment that we experience at the moment of death. At the moment of death, it is at that point that the determination is made whether I'm going to go to heaven or whether I'm going to go to hell. There is no do-overs after that point. There is no, okay, you know, I think I messed that up. I need to go back and do that again. We don't get to do that. We don't get to do that. That's why there is such a sense of urgency, that at that moment we experience the particular judgment that determines whether or not I'm going to go to heaven or I'm going to go to hell. Now, what is heaven? What is heaven? Heaven is the destiny that God intends for each and every one of us. He created us for heaven. And there's a quote in the book from the Catechism of the Catholic Church that says that heaven is the end and fulfillment of the deepest human longings, the state of supreme definitive happiness. It is the fulfillment of the deepest human longings. The church does not define heaven primarily as a place, but as a state of being. The same thing is going to be true for hell. The church does not teach hell as a place, but as a state of being. And heaven is a state of being in which we experience the fulfillment of all of the deepest human longings that we have, and the state of supreme, definitive happiness. The scriptures use a number of different images to try to help us to understand what heaven might be like. It uses the image of a banquet, all right, and especially a wedding banquet, the wedding banquet of the king, the messianic banquet. For a people who lived in the desert, this is a pretty apt image for them for what heaven might be like. If you live in a place where scraping a living is and trying to make sure that you've got enough food on a day-to-day basis is something that is very, very difficult, then when you think of what is heaven going to be like, it's going to be where there's plenty of food and I don't have to work for it. Where I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm going to be able to provide for my family. And so they have this idea of this banquet with the choicest meats and fruits and vegetables, where there is plenty of wine flowing, where it is just wonderful. And it's the wedding banquet. The Jewish people loved the wedding banquets. They loved to celebrate those. There were great, great celebrations. There was great joy. There was great happiness that was there. And it was like a wedding banquet that goes on and on and on and on and on. Jesus taps into this with the wedding feast of Cana, where he is there and he is celebrating with them. And Jewish wedding feasts did tend to go on for several days. And this one has gone on to the point that they've run out of wine. All right? They have drunk up all the wine that they intended for the entire celebration. And so what is it that Jesus does? He makes more wine. And he doesn't make just a little bit of wine. He takes 6 stone water jars that hold approximately 25 gallons, and he tells the servants to fill them to the brim. And so Jesus made approximately 150 gallons of wine. And this is after they have drunk everything else. And it is the best wine that any of them have ever tasted. Can you imagine what that wine must have been like? That wine that Jesus made there that day. But again, this is the messianic banquet. This is what heaven is going to be, where there is this great, great, wonderful banquet. The Father's house is another image that is given to us. In the parable of the prodigal son, when the prodigal son leaves the Father's house, he leaves the Father's house. When he sins, he leaves the Father's house. When he converts, he returns to the Father's house. But then also the elder son, when he learns that his younger son has returned and that there is a party going on, a banquet going on in the Father's house, what does the elder son do? He refuses to go in to the Father's house. The younger son had excluded himself from the Father's house by his sinfulness. The elder son excludes himself from the Father's house by his self-righteousness. He refuses to enter the Father's house. But again, where is heaven? Heaven's the Father's house. Jesus tells us this when he tells the apostles at one point, he says, I'm going away now to prepare a place for you. And then I will come back to take you with me, that where I am, you also will be. In my Father's house, there are many mansions. There are many mansions, and I'm going to prepare one of those for you. And so the Father's house is what heaven is about, a place where we are in the Father's care, where we are in the Father's love, where we are in the Father's protection. Unending happiness is another image that, or another thing, the way we describe heaven. The beatific vision, this is one of the ways in which the church describes heaven, that heaven is going to be the vision of God himself. Last year, Pope Benedict XVI, I think it was on the Feast of the Assumption of Mary, which is really about heaven, because it's about Mary being taken body and soul into heaven. And he was talking about what is heaven, and he says, heaven is God. Heaven is God. What is it that makes heaven heaven is the presence of God. Where God is heaven. Where God is not, is hell. This is why St. Catherine of Siena could say to us, it's heaven all the way to heaven, and it's hell all the way to hell. That those who are on the way to heaven are already beginning to experience the reality of God's presence and God's love in their lives. And those who are on their way to hell are experiencing the emptiness and the isolation and the separation from God, even in this life. And so it's, now to say it's heaven all the way to heaven doesn't mean that it's all fun and games all the way to heaven. We may very well have to go through great suffering and sorrow, and Jesus promises we will, but we will do so with an awareness of the presence of God. We will know God. And in heaven, we will be just completely overwhelmed by the beauty and the glory and the wonder and of God, right? To be completely captivated by that. Now, again, I think we have our images, the way that we tend, I think, to think about heaven very often is very insipid. It's very tepid. It's very superficial. Mark Twain, the great humorist, was also a great cynic, and he wrote at one time about Christians and their ideas of heaven. And he says what they want, they think of heaven, this place that they want to spend eternity, going around doing things with that they would never do on earth, with people that they would never hang out with on earth. All right? And he sees, walking around with people that they would never want to associate with, plucking on harps and singing holy songs. And, you know, if that's our image of a heaven, it does become, it's like, well, that's going to get old rather quickly, don't you think? All right? That kind of an image of heaven. Heaven has to be something much more dynamic and much more alive than that. And that's where we come to the beatific vision. And we're going to think, oh, okay, now what's this beatific vision? And some of you have heard me talk about this in my funeral homily. As I talk about this, when you think in terms of vision, of seeing, what is the most beautiful sight that you have ever seen? The most beautiful scene in nature that you have ever experienced? Again, perhaps it's being out in the yard on a beautiful, beautiful moonless night where you can just see the whole Milky Way so alive, and you can just see all the constellations that are there. Maybe it's a night with a full moon. We just had full moon of like a week ago or so, and I love the full moon. I just love to see the sky on those nights, and the full moon is just so wonderful. Maybe it was camping at some time and being out in the woods, or maybe it was being at the ocean or somewhere, maybe at the Grand Canyon. Wow, when I went to the Grand Canyon, boy, that's just the sense of the awesomeness of that, the grandness of the Grand Canyon. There's just something that happens to you when you're standing there at the rim of the canyon and looking at this. There is something inside of you that begins to open up, all right, and to experience from the inside out the sense of wonder and awe. Let's just imagine that. Imagine that, and multiply that by a billion, and a billion, and a billion. And imagine just, oh my God, oh my God, how incredible, how awesome. Or again, the most beautiful piece of art. I've shared this before too. For me, the piece of art, the piece of sculpture, which never fails to just absolutely astound me, is the Pietà, Michelangelo's Pietà. To stand there in St. Peter's Basilica, and again, 10 years ago, I was on sabbatical in Rome, was there for 3 months, and at least once a week, I would go down to St. Peter's, and I would just stand there for 10, 15, 20 minutes, just looking at this statue. And you can't really get close to it anymore. Back in the 70s or so, there was somebody who attacked it with a hammer, and so now there's a big plate glass there, so you can't actually get up to it like you used to be able to. But still, you just look, and this is marble. So this is what absolutely astounds me, is that this is made out of marble, which is hard. And you look at this piece of sculpture, and the robe of the Blessed Mother, and you just look at the gracefulness of the rolls of the cloth that are there, and you look at her face, the beauty of her face. You see her holding the body of her son. It is such an exquisite piece of work. And for you, maybe it was something else, but just to think about that, and think a billion and a billion and a billion, or a piece of music. Piece of music, the most beautiful piece of music. Maybe it was a symphony that you went to, maybe it was an opera, right? Maybe it was a rock concert, maybe whatever it was that just wowed you, where you were just like, oh, oh, a billion and a billion and a billion. And we begin a sense of the beatific vision of what it is that God has in store for us. St. Paul tells us that we can't really understand. He says, eye is not seen, ear is not heard, and the human mind cannot even conceive of what God has planned for those who love Him. But we try. We try to get at that. We try to get hold of that using what we have. And Jesus gives us various images. St. Paul and the other writers give us various images to understand what it is, the beatific vision, which will just simply fill us with wonder and awe and joy and peace. And finally, there is communion. Communion with the Trinity itself. So I'm not just going to stand there kind of passively looking at God. Wow, there's God. God is really amazing. Look how incredible God is. No, there will be a communion with God, a knowing God, a being known by God, a oneness with God that will satisfy the human longings in a way that nothing ever else could. When you fall in love, and when somebody else, the one that you're in love with, falls back in love with you, how that feels. And to be there in the presence of the God who loves me, the God who is in love with me. Can you imagine just the flood of grace and love that's going to come off of Him as you're with Him and experience that? But not only our communion with God, with the Trinity, but it's also our union with the whole communion of saints, with Mary and Joseph and Francis and all of the saints and all of those who are the unnamed saints, all of our parents and grandparents and all who have gone before us, and to be there with one another. It's going to be amazing. It's going to be awesome. This is what God has planned for us. And so at the moment of the particular judgment, I will either be going to hell or I will be going towards heaven. Now, I may not be ready for heaven when I die. In fact, probably most of us will not yet be ready for heaven. Because in heaven, I can't take any of my garbage with me. All right? I can't take any of my sinfulness, my selfishness with me in heaven. It won't be heaven if I'm carrying that stuff around with me, because I'll be messing it up for other people and for myself. And if you got all your stuff, man, it's just going to be more of this. And do you really want to do an eternity of what we've got here in this life? All right? Do you want to live forever this life? No. The only reason that we can imagine living forever as something wonderful is because it's going to be something other than what we experience now. All right? There's this life. There's a lot of good things about this life. But it's not wonderful enough that I want to do it for eternity. All right? So, we have to be purified. This is what purgatory is about. It is the process that gets us ready. Now, I want to read in the book on page 154 where it talks about purgatory, because I thought they really did a good job of summarizing what it is. First of all, it uses a quote from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. It's on page 154 where it begins. The Church gives the name purgatory. That's where I'm going to begin. The Church, this is again a quote from the Catechism of the Catholic Church. The Church gives the name purgatory to the final purification of the elect. The elect are those who are chosen, those who are on their way to heaven. The final purification of the elect. So purgatory is not a second chance for those who messed up the first one. All right? There is no second chance. If we mess up the first one, we're going to hell. This is for people who have not messed up, who are on their way to heaven. But this purification, which is entirely different from the punishments of the damned. This is an important point. This is not the way that purgatory was taught to me when I was growing up. I was taught that the punishments or the sufferings of purgatory were very, very much like the sufferings of hell. The only difference was that hell went on forever and purgatory only went on for about 12,000 years. All right? Is that kind of what you got? All right? That's the purgatory was all the suffering. It was actually fire. It was just like the fires of hell, except there was going to be some relief from me 12,000 years from now. All right? Now, I don't know about you, but my sense of burning for 12,000 years feels a lot like hell. All right? But the Church says no. They are entirely different realities. And again, the Church does not treat them as places, but as states of being, right? States of being. When we are in purgatory, well, let's just go on and hear what it says. Those who die in the state of friendship with God, those who are saved, but who are not fully purified and perfected, are assured of their eternal salvation. That's why purgatory is actually going to be better than this, all right? Because we're closer to heaven, and we are absolutely assured in purgatory that we're on our way to heaven. Well, you and I know what the church teaches us is that we still can mess this thing up. We could still mess this thing up. That's the scary thing about believing in hell, is if I believe that hell exists, there is a possibility that I could end up there. All right? That's why I think many of us have tried to convince ourselves that there is no such thing as hell, because we really don't like the idea that we might end up there. All right? So, but the reality is that in purgatory, there is no chance in the world. There is no chance whatsoever that those who are in purgatory are going to end up in hell. The only place they could possibly end up is going to be heaven. All right? So, they are assured of their eternal salvation. However, they must undergo a purification to obtain the perfection of love and holiness needed to enter heaven, where they have a heart that is totally open to Him, to God. This process is called purgatory. What is it that's saying here? All right? If I was to die today, if I am in a state of grace, if I have repented of my sins, I have confessed any mortal sins, I have received absolution, and then I am forgiven. I am forgiven. Purgatory has nothing to do with forgiveness. Our sins are forgiven. So it's not about forgiveness. So what is it about? It's about the stain of sin. All right? You've heard me probably talking about St. Paul's image of sin, which is not simply, okay, I broke a rule and now I need to be forgiven for it, but something much more, which the way I describe it is kind of a virus that's in the hard drive of our souls. That there's something has gone wrong with me. There is something wrong inside of me that leads me to sin. As St. Paul says, the things I am determined to do, I do not do. And the things that I promise I'm not going to do, I keep doing them. And he talks about the sin that lives within. And so I need forgiveness for my sin, but I need much more than that. I need to be set free from sin. I need to be purified so that I don't bring selfishness and greed and resentment and bitterness and all of this garbage into heaven. It won't be heaven if I'm still packing that stuff around, right? So if I die today and I have not completed the journey of holiness, which if any of you who know me very well can be sure, I haven't, all right? I have not completed the journey of holiness. Then there's work to do. And purgatory is where that gets completed, where I will be given that heart that is completely open to God, completely open to God's love, completely open to grace, and I'll be like Mary. We talked about this at the Feast of the Immaculate Conception. When I, like Mary, will be full of grace, and I can't be full of grace if there's some sin in there. All right? And again, I'm not talking about the guilt of sin. We're set free from the guilt of sin by confession and baptism. I'm talking about the stain of sin. I'm talking about the effects of sin still at work in us. And we need to be set free from this. Purgatory is a place of healing. It's a place of healing. It's a good place. And that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. It doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Almost nothing that I can tell that Jesus has told us about the spiritual life is easy. Right? It's very simple, maybe, but it's not easy. It's going to call us to continue to die to ourselves, to let go of self, to let go of self-will, to let go of anything in us that is not of God. And there may very well be pain that is involved in that. Fire is an image that is used to describe purgatory, but the Catechism uses the idea that it's the fire of God's love. The fire of God's love that is burning and purifying us. It's not the fire of God's rage, right? It's not the fire of God's rage. It's the fire of God's love that is consuming whatever is not beautiful, whatever is not true, whatever is not good that is in me, all right? So, that's what purgatory is. How long does it last? Who knows? Who knows? Let's go on and see what else it says. This process is called purgatory. Purgatory, then, is a process that we go through. It is a state of being. It is impossible for us to imagine what purgatory is. Again, we try, we use images from this life to try to get at it. Traditionally, it has been described as purifying fire. Since the human soul cannot be touched by earthly flames, purgatory is before the resurrection of the body. There is no body at this point. All right? When we die, there's a separation of the body and the soul. We're going to talk about the resurrection of the body in a little bit. But at this point, the resurrection of the body has not taken place. It is only the soul that is in purgatory. Fire, real fire, physical fire, would have no effect on the human soul. Therefore, that can't be what it's about. Since the human soul cannot be touched by earthly flames, the image serves to recall that perfect love is achieved by a gradual and painful spiritual detachment from selfishness and self-centeredness. The church assists those in purgatory through prayer, and especially the Eucharist, in their final process of purification. Offering masses for the deceased is a most powerful way of aiding them. November 2nd of each year, the commemoration of all the faithful departed, All Souls Day, is a day for special remembrance and prayer for the dead. So we pray for the dead. We believe our prayer can help those who are in purgatory, that we can help them to continue this process, and it's important for us to do that. Now, we talked about heaven, what that is. We talked about purgatory. But what is hell? What is hell? Hell is a state of eternal separation from God. And those who are in hell are there because that is where they want to be. Now, that sounds odd to us because, we imagine hell as a place with horrible fire and torment. And who would want to be there? Nobody. Nobody. But the fire here is not, again, it's not the fire even of God's wrath. All right? It's the fire of their emptiness, of their bitterness, of their separation and isolation from God, of their choosing things that can never satisfy and rejecting the one thing that can satisfy. The people who are in hell because they would be more miserable in heaven than they would be in hell. They are more comfortable in hell than they would be in heaven. C.S. Lewis shows this in his book, The Great Divorce, where he shows this group of people from hell who take a day trip to heaven. And many of them are more miserable in heaven because they don't fit in heaven. So they actually fit in hell, right? They actually belong in hell. They're miserable, but it's an entirely different misery than the one that they experience when they are in heaven, when they still have the same kind of spiritual sickness going on, and they're in a place where everybody is lovey-dovey, and everybody is wonderful and happy, and it's like, yuck, get me out of here. Get me out of here. So it is a place of eternal separation from God. Serious sin separates us from God. Serious sin is our rejection of God and of God's plan for us. When we are saying to God, God, I know you have a plan for me. I know what your will for me is, and I'm not interested. I'm not interested. I'm going to go my own way. I'm going to choose my own path. I'm going to choose my own happiness. And if I reject God, God will not force himself upon me. God is a very gentle lover. He is not a rapist. God is head over heels in love with me. And he wants nothing more than for me to turn to him with all my heart. But he will never make me do that. He will do everything possible throughout my entire life to try to seduce me and to win me over. But he will not force my will. And so if I say, no, God, no, I don't choose you. I don't choose your will for me. I don't choose your plan for me. I don't choose your grace. I choose to go my own on my own way. God will sadly let me go and do that. Right? Hoping that I'm going to eventually wake up and realize what I'm doing and turn back to Him. But if I eternally reject God, God will eternally respect my decision.